She has a slender face, pleasingly feline features, spare, straight brows. Her eyes are heavy-lidded and boldly lined on the top lids, in the manner of 1960s movie stars. Her hair is middle-parted, gathered into a chignon, and she wears stylishly narrow, tortoise-shell glasses. A gray wool skirt and a thin blue sweater cling suggestively to her sides. Opaque black tights cover her calves. A collection of white shopping bags lie at the base of her stool. On the phone, he hadn't bothered to ask what she looked like, assuming he'd recognize her, but now he is no longer sure. "Moshumi?" he says, approaching her. "Hey there," she says, closing the cover of the book and kissing him casually on both sides of his face. The book has a plain ivory cover, a title written in French. Her British accent, one of the few things he clearly remembers about her, is gone. She sounds as American as he does, with the low, gravelly voice that had surprised him on the phone. She has ordered herself a martini with olives. Beside it is a blue packet of Dunhill's. "Nikhil," she says as he sits down on the stool beside her and orders a single malt. "Yes?" "As opposed to Goggle." "Yes." It had annoyed him when he'd called her that she hadn't recognized him as Nikhil. This is the first time he's been out with a woman who'd once known him by that other name. On the phone, she'd sounded guarded, faintly suspicious as he had. The conversation had been brief and thoroughly awkward. "I hope you don't mind my calling," he'd begun, after explaining to her that he'd changed his name. "Let me check my book," she'd told him when he'd asked if she were free Sunday evening for a drink, and then he'd listened to her footsteps clicking across a bare wooden floor. She studies him for a moment, playfully twisting her lips. "As I recall, given that you're a year older than me, I was taught by my parents to call you Goggle Dada." He is aware of the bartender glancing at them briefly, assessing their potential. He can smell Moshumi's perfume, something slightly overpowering that makes him think of wet moss and prunes. The silence and the intimacy of the room disconcerts him. "Let's not dwell on that," she laughs. "I'll drink to that," she says, lifting her glass. "I never did, of course," she adds.
"Did what?"
"Call you Goggle Dada." "I don't remember our ever talking, really." He sips his drink. "Neither do I." "So, I've never done this before," she says after a pause. She speaks matter-of-factly, but nevertheless she averts her gaze. He knows what she is referring to. In spite of this, he asks, "Done what?" "Gone out on a blind date that's been engineered by my mom?" "Well, it's not a blind date, exactly," he says. "No? We already know each other, in a way." She shrugs and gives a quick smile, as if she has yet to be convinced. Her teeth are crowded together, not entirely straight. I guess we do. Together, they watch as the bartender puts the CD into the player mounted to the wall. Some jazz. He is thankful for the distraction. "I was sorry to hear about your father," she says. Though she sounds genuinely sympathetic, he wonders whether she even remembers his father. He is tempted to ask her, but instead he nods. "Thanks," he says, all he can ever think to say. "How is your mother getting along?" "All right, I guess. Is she okay on her own?" "Sonia's living with her now." "Oh, that's good. That must be a relief to you." She reaches for the Dunhills, opening the box and peeling back the gold foil. After offering one to him, she reaches for the book of matches that lies in an ashtray on the bar and lights a cigarette for herself. "Do you guys still live in that same house I used to visit?" she asks.
"Yeah. I remember it."
"Do you?" "I remember that the driveway was to the right of the house as you faced it. There was a flagstone path cut into the lawn." The fact that she can recall these details so precisely is at once startling and endearing to him. "Wow, I'm impressed." "I also remember watching lots of television in a room covered with really thick brownish gold carpeting." He groans. "It still is." She apologizes for not being at the funeral. She'd been in Paris at the time. It was where she'd lived after graduating from Brown, she explains. Now she is a candidate for a PhD in French literature at NYU.
She's been living in the city for almost 2 years. She's spent the past summer temping, working for 2 months in the business office of an expensive midtown hotel. Her job was to review and file all the exit surveys left by the guests, make copies, distribute them to the appropriate people. This simple task had taken up her day. She'd been amazed by the energy people put into surveys. They complained about the pillows being too hard or too soft, or that there wasn't enough space around the sinks for their toiletries, or that the bed skirt had a loose thread. Most of the people didn't even pay for the rooms themselves. They were at conventions, everything expensed. One person had complained that an architectural print above the desk had a visible speck of dust under the glass. The anecdote amuses him. "That might have been me," he speculates. She laughs. "Why did you leave Paris for New York?" he asks. "I think you'd rather study French literature in France." "I moved here for love," she says. Her frankness surprises him. "Surely you know about my prenuptial disaster." "Not really," he lies. "Well, you ought to," she shakes her head. "Every other Bengali living on the East Coast does." She speaks of it lightly, but he detects a bitterness in her voice. "In fact, I'm pretty sure you and your family were invited to the wedding." "When was the last time we saw each other?" he says, in an effort to change the subject. "Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it was your high school graduation party." His mind goes back to a brightly lit space in the basement of a church his parents and their friends sometimes rented for especially large parties. It was where Sunday school classes were normally held. In the hallways were felt hangings, mottos about Jesus. He remembers the big, long folding tables that he had helped his father to set up, chalkboards on the walls, Sonia standing up on a chair, writing, "Congratulations." "You were there?" She nods. "It was right before we moved to New Jersey. You sat with your American friends from high school. A few of your teachers were there. You seemed a little embarrassed by it all." He shakes his head. "I don't remember you there. Did I speak to you?" "You ignored me thoroughly. But it doesn't matter," she smiles. "I'm sure I brought a book with me." They have a second round of drinks. The bar is beginning to fill up, small groups occupying each of the booths, people sitting on either side of them. A large party enters, and now there are patrons standing behind them to order drinks. When he had arrived, he'd been bothered by the lack of people, of sounds, feeling on display, but now the crowd bothers him even more. "It's getting pretty crazy in here," he says. "It's not usually like this on a Sunday. Should we leave?" He considers. "Maybe." They ask for the bill, step out together into the cool October evening. Glancing at his watch, he sees that not even an hour has passed. "Where are you headed?" she asks, in a way that makes him realize that she assumes the date is over. He hadn't planned to take her to dinner. He'd intended to go back to his apartment after the drink and study and order in some Chinese food. But now he finds himself saying that he is thinking of getting something to eat. Did she want to join him? "I'd like that," she says. Neither can think of a place to go, and so they decide to walk a bit. He offers to carry her shopping bags, and though they weigh nothing at all, she allows him to, telling him she'd been to a sample sale in Soho just before they'd met. They stop in front of a small place that looks as if it has just opened. They study the handwritten menu taped to the window, the review that was printed a few days ago in the Times. He is distracted by her reflection in the glass, a more severe version of herself, for some reason more stunning. "Shall we try it?" he asks, stepping away and reaching for the door. Inside, the walls are painted red. They are surrounded by old posters advertising wine and street signs and photographs of Paris arranged above the picture rails. "This place must seem silly to you," he acknowledges, watching her gaze up at the walls. She shakes her head. "It's pretty authentic, actually." She asks for a glass of champagne and looks carefully at the wine list. He asks for another single malt, but is told that there is only beer and wine. "Shall we have a bottle?" she says, handing him the list. "You choose." She orders a salad and the bouillabaisse and a bottle of Sancerre. He orders the cassoulet. She doesn't speak French to the waiter, who is French himself, but the way she pronounces the items on the menu makes it clear that she is fluent. It impresses him. Apart from Bengali, he has never bothered to master another language. The meal passes quickly. He speaks of his work, the projects he is involved in, his upcoming exam. They comment on each other's dishes, trading tastes on their bread plates. They order espresso and share a creme brulee. their 2 teaspoons cracking the hard amber surface from either side. She offers to pay her share when the bill comes, as she'd done in the bar, but this time he insists on treating. He walks her to her apartment, which is on a run-down but pretty residential block, close to the bar where they'd met. Her building has a crumbling stoop, a terracotta-colored facade with a gaudy green cornice. She thanks him for the dinner, says she's had a great time. Again, she kisses him on both cheeks, then begins to search for the keys in her purse. "Don't forget these." He gives her the shopping bags, watches as she loops them over her wrist. Now that he is no longer carrying them, he feels awkward, unsure what to do with his hands. He is parched from the alcohol he has consumed. "So should we make our parents happy and see each other again?" She looks at him, studying his face intently. "Maybe." Her eyes stray to a passing car in the street, the headlights briefly shining on their bodies, but then her gaze returns to his face. She smiles at him, nodding. "Give me a call." He watches as she ascends quickly up the stoop with her shopping bags, her heels suspended over the treads in a way that looks precarious. She turns briefly to wave at him, and then she goes through a second glass door, not waiting to see him waving back. For a minute longer, he stands there, watching as the door opens again and a tenant emerges to deposit something into one of the trash cans below the stoop. Goggle looks up at the building, wondering which of the apartments is hers, waiting to see if a light will turn on in one of the windows. He had not expected to enjoy himself, to be attracted to her in the least. It strikes him that there is no term for what they once were to each other. Their parents were friends, not they. She is a family acquaintance, but she is not family. Their contact until tonight has been artificial, imposed, something like his relationship to his cousins in India, but lacking even the justification of blood ties. Until they'd met tonight, he had never seen her outside the context of her family, or she his. He decides that it is the very familiarity that makes him curious about her, and as he begins to walk west, to the subway, he wonders when he might see her again. When he reaches Broadway, he changes his mind and hails a cab. The decision feels indulgent, as it is not particularly late, or cold, or raining, and he is in no great rush to be home. But he has the urge to be alone all of a sudden, to be thoroughly passive, to revisit the evening in solitude. The driver of the cab is a Bangladeshi. The name on the registration card, pasted to the plexiglass behind the front seat, says Mustafa Saeed. He is talking in Bengali on his cell phone, complaining of the traffic on the FDR, of difficult passengers as they sail uptown past the shuttered shops and restaurants on 8th Avenue. If his parents were in the cab, they would have struck up a conversation with the driver, asking what part of Bangladesh he was from, how long he'd been in this country, whether his wife or children lived here or there. Goggle sits silently, as if he were any other passenger, lost in his own thoughts, thinking of Moshumi. But as they near his apartment, he leans toward the plexiglass and says to the driver in Bengali, "It's that one, up on the right." The driver turns around, surprised, smiling. "I didn't realize," he says. "That's okay," Goggle says, reaching for his wallet. He tips the driver excessively and steps out of the car. In the days that follow, he begins to remember things about Moshumi, images that come to him without warning while he is sitting at his desk at work, or during a meeting, or drifting off to sleep, or standing in the mornings under the shower. They are scenes he has carried within him, buried but intact, scenes he has never thought about or had reason to conjure up until now. He is grateful that his mind has retained these images of her, pleased with himself, as if he has just discovered the innate talent for a sport or a game he's never played. He remembers her mainly at the pujos he had attended every year, twice a year with his family, where she would be dressed in a sari carefully pinned to the top of her shoulder. Sonia would have to do the same, but she would always take off her sari after an hour or two and put on her jeans, stuffing the sari into a plastic bag and telling Goggle or their father to put it away for her in the car. He does not remember Moshumi ever accompanying the other teenagers to the McDonald's that was across the street from the building in Watertown where the pujos often were, or eventually sitting in someone's car in the parking lot listening to the radio and drinking beer from a can. He struggles but fails to recall her presence at Pemberton Road. Still, he is secretly pleased that she has seen those rooms, tasted his mother's cooking, washed her hands in the bathroom, however long ago. He remembers once going to a Christmas party at her parents' home. He and Sonia had not wanted to go. Christmas was supposed to be spent with just family. But their parents had replied that in America, Bengali friends were the closest thing they had to family, and so they had gone to Bedford, where the Mazumdars lived. Her mother, Rina Mashi, had served cold pound cake and warmed up frozen donuts that deflated at the touch. Her brother Samrat, now a senior in high school, had been a boy of four, obsessed with Spider-Man. Rina Mashi had gone to a great deal of trouble to organize an anonymous gift exchange. Each family was asked to bring as many gifts as there were members, so that there would be something for everyone to open. Goggle had been asked to write numbers on squares of paper, one set to tape onto the gifts and another to pass around, folded up in a drawstring pouch, to the guests. Everyone gathered in a single room, cramming through the two doorways. He remembers sitting in their living room, listening with all the other guests to Moshumi play something on the piano. On the wall above her was a framed reproduction of Renoir's Girl with a green watering can. After great deliberation, just as people were beginning to fidget, she had played a short piece by Mozart, adapted for children, but the guests wanted her to play Jingle Bells. She shook her head no, but her mother said, "Oh, Moshumi's just being shy. She knows very well how to play Jingle Bells." For an instant, she had glared at her mother, but then she'd played the song, again and again, as the numbers were called out and people claimed their gifts, sitting with her back to the room. A week later, they meet for lunch. It is the middle of the week, and she has offered to meet him someplace near his office, so he's told her to come to the building where he works. When the receptionist tells him she's waiting in the lobby, he feels the anticipation rise in his chest. All morning he'd been unable to concentrate on the elevation he was working on. He spends a few minutes showing her around, pointing out photographs of projects he's worked on, introducing her to one of the principal designers, showing her the room where the partners meet. His co-workers in the drafting room look up from their desks as she passes by. It is early November, a day on which the temperature has suddenly dropped, bringing the first true cold of the year. Outside, unprepared pedestrians scurry past unhappily, arms folded across their chests. Fallen leaves, battered and bleached, scuttle in swirls on the pavement. Goggle has no hat or gloves, and as they walk he puts his hands into the pockets of his jacket. Moshumi, in contrast, seems enviably protected, at ease in the cold. She wears a navy wool coat, a black wool scarf at her throat, long black leather boots that zip up the sides. He takes her to an Italian restaurant where he goes from time to time with people at work to celebrate birthdays and promotions and projects well done. The entrance is a few steps below street level, the window shielded with panels of lace. The waiter recognizes him, smiles. They are led to a small table at the back, as opposed to the long one in the center that he normally sits at. Underneath the coat, he sees that she is wearing a nubbly gray suit, with large buttons on the jacket and a bell-shaped skirt that stops short of her knees. "I taught today," she explains, aware that he is looking at her. She preferred to wear a suit when she taught, she says, given that her students were only a decade younger than she was. Otherwise, she feels no sense of authority. He envies her students suddenly, seeing her without fail, three times a week, pictures them gathered together around a table, staring at her continuously as she writes on the board. "The pastas are usually pretty good here," he says as the waiter hands them menus. "Join me for a glass of wine," she says. "I'm done for the day." "Lucky you. I have a stressful meeting to go to after this." She looks at him, closing the menu. "All the more reason for a drink," she points out cheerfully. "True," he concedes. "Two glasses of the Merlot," he says when the waiter returns. She orders what he does, porcini ravioli and a salad of arugula and pears. He's nervous that she'll be disappointed by the choice, but when the food arrives, she eyes it approvingly, and she eats heartily, quickly, sopping up the leftover sauce on her plate with bread. As they drink their wine and eat their meal, he admires the light on her face, the faint pale hairs that shine against the contours of her cheek. She speaks of her students, the topic for the dissertation she plans to write, about 20th century Francophone poets from Algeria. He tells her about his memory of the Christmas party, of her being forced to play Jingle Bells. "Do you remember that night?" he asks, hopeful that she will. "No. My mother was always forcing me to do things like that." "Do you still play?" She shakes her head. "I never wanted to learn in the first place. My mother had this fantasy, one of many. I think my mother's taking lessons now." The room is quiet again. The lunch crowd has come and gone. He looks around for the waiter, signals for the check, dismayed that their plates are empty, that the hour has passed.
"She's your sister, signore?"
the waiter asks as he sets the check between them, glancing at Moshimi and then back at Goggle.
"Oh, no," Goggle says, shaking his head, laughing, at once insulted and oddly aroused. In a way, he realizes, it's true. They share the same coloring, the straight eyebrows, the long, slender bodies, the high cheekbones and dark hair.
"You are sure?" the waiter persists.
"Quite sure," Goggle says.
"But you could be," the waiter says. "Si, si, there is quite a resemblance."
"You think so?" Moshimi says. She appears to be at ease with the comparison, looking comically askance at Goggle. And yet he notices that some color has risen to her cheeks, whether from the wine or from self-consciousness he doesn't know.
"It's funny he should say that," she says once they have stepped out into the cold.
"What do you mean?"
"Well, it's just funny to think that all our lives our parents raised us according to the illusion that we were cousins, that we are all part of some makeshift extended Bengali family. And now here we are, years later, and someone actually thinks we're related."
He does not know what to say. The waiter's comment has discomforted him, making his attraction to Moshimi feel mildly illicit.
"You're not dressed warmly enough," she observes, twisting the woolen scarf securely around her neck. "It's so damn hot in my apartment all the time," he says. "The heat just got turned on. For some reason, I can never get my mind around the fact that it won't be the same temperature outside."
"Don't you check the paper?"
"I get it on my way to work."
"I always check the weather by phone when I leave the house," Moshimi says.
"You're joking," he stares at her, surprised that she should actually be the type to go to such lengths. "Please tell me you're joking."
She laughs.
"I don't admit that just to anyone, you know."
She finishes arranging her scarf, and then, without removing her hands from it, she says, "Why don't you borrow this?" and begins to untie it again.
"Please, I'm fine," he puts a hand to his throat against the knot of his tie.
"Sure?"
He nods, half tempted to say yes, to feel her scarf against his skin.
"Well, at the very least, you need a hat," she tells him. "I know a place nearby. Do you need to be back at work right away?"
She leads him to a little boutique on Madison. The window is crowded with women's hats perched on gray, featureless heads with sloping necks nearly a foot long.
"They have men's stuff in the back," she says.
The shop is crowded with women. The back is relatively tranquil, stacks of fedoras and berets arranged on curved wooden shelves. He picks up a fur hat, a top hat, trying them on as a joke. The glass of wine has made him tipsy. Moshimi begins rummaging through a basket.
"This will be warm," she says, placing her fingers inside a thick navy cap with yellow stripes on the brim. She stretches the hat with her fingers. "What do you think?" She puts it on his head, touching his hair, his scalp. She smiles, pointing to the mirror. She watches as he studies himself. He is aware that she is looking at him rather than at his reflection. He wonders what her face looks like without her glasses when her hair is loose. He wonders what it might be like to kiss her on the mouth.
"I like it," he says. "I'll take it."
She pulls it off his head quickly, spoiling his hair. "What are you doing?"
"I want to buy it for you."
"You don't have to do that."
"I want to," she says, already heading toward the register.
"It was my idea anyway. You were perfectly happy freezing to death." At the register, the cashier notices Moshimi eyeing a brown wool and velvet hat decorated with feathers.
"It's an exquisite piece," the cashier says, carefully lifting it off the bust. "Handmade by a woman in Spain. No two are alike. Would you like to try it?"
Moshimi places it on her head. A customer compliments her. So does the cashier.
"Not many women can pull off a hat like that," the cashier says.
Moshimi blushes, glances at the price tag dangling from a thread on one side of her face.
"I'm afraid it's out of my budget for today," she says.
The cashier replaces the hat on the shelf.
"Well, now you know what to get her for her birthday," she says, looking at Goggle.
He puts on the new cap and they step out of the store. He is late for his meeting. If it weren't for that, he would be tempted to stay with her, to walk through the streets beside her, or disappear with her into the dark of a movie theater. The day has turned even colder, the wind more forceful, the sun a faint white patch. She walks him back to his office. For the rest of the day, throughout his meeting, and as he struggles afterward to get back to work, he thinks of her. When he leaves the office, instead of walking to the subway, he retraces the steps they'd taken together earlier, past the restaurant where people are now having their dinners, and finds his way to the hat store, the sight of it lifting his spirits. It's nearly 8 o'clock, dark outside. He assumes the store will be closed, is surprised to see the light still on inside, the grate only partly lowered. He studies the items in the window, and his reflection in the glass wearing the cap she'd bought for him. Eventually he walks in. He's the only customer. He can hear the sound of a vacuum cleaner running at the rear of the store.
"I knew you'd be back," the saleswoman says as he walks through the door.
She takes the brown velvet hat off the styrofoam head without his having to ask. "He was here earlier today with his girlfriend," she explains to her assistant. "Shall I wrap it for you?" That would be great. It excites him to hear himself refer to that way. He watches as the hat is placed in a round chocolate-colored box, tied with a thick, creamy ribbon. He realizes that he has not asked the price, but without a thought, he signs the receipt for $200. He takes the hat back to his apartment, hiding it at the back of his closet, even though Moshimi has never been there. He would give it to her on her birthday, in spite of the fact he has no idea when her birthday is. And yet he has the feeling that he has been to a few of her birthdays, and she to his. That weekend at his parents' house, he confirms this. At night, after his mother and Sonia have gone up to bed, he hunts for her in the photo albums that his mother has assembled over the years. Moshimi is there, lined up behind a blazing cake in his parents' dining room. She's looking away, a pointed paper hat on her head. He stares straight at the lens, the knife in his hand, poised, for the camera's benefit, over the cake, his face shining with impending adolescence. He tries to peel the image from the sticky yellow backing to show her the next time he sees her, but it clings stubbornly, refusing to detach cleanly from the past. The following weekend, she invites him over for dinner at her place. She has to come downstairs in order to let him into the building. The buzzer is broken, she'd warned him when they'd made their plans. "Nice cap," she says. She wears a sleeveless black dress tied loosely at the back. Her legs are bare, her feet slim, her toenails exposed at the top of her sandals, painted maroon. Strands of hair have come loose from her chignon. She holds half a cigarette between her fingers, but just before she leans forward to kiss him on the cheeks, she lets it drop and crushes it with the toe of her sandal. She leads him up the steps to an apartment on the third floor. She's left the door open. The apartment smells strongly of cooking. On the stove, a few large pieces of chicken are browning in a pan full of oil. Music is playing, a man singing songs in French. Goggle gives her a bunch of sunflowers, whose massive stems are heavier in his arms than the bottle of wine he's also brought. She does not know where to put the flowers. The countertops, limited to begin with, are crammed with evidence of the meal she is preparing. Onions and mushrooms, flour, a stick of butter rapidly softening in the heat, a glass of wine she is in the process of drinking, plastic grocery bags she has not had time to put away. "I should have brought something more manageable," he says as she looks around the kitchen, the flowers resting against her shoulder, as if expecting a surface to miraculously clear. "I've been meaning for weeks to buy myself some sunflowers," she says. She glances quickly at the pan on the stove and takes him through the kitchen and into the living room. She unwraps the flowers. "There's a vase up there," she says, pointing to the top of a bookcase. "Would you mind getting it down?" She carries the vase into the bathroom, and he can hear water running in the tub. He takes the opportunity to remove his coat and cap, drape them over the back of the sofa. He is dressed with care, a blue and white striped Italian shirt that Sonia had bought him at Filene's basement, a pair of black jeans. She returns and fills the vase with the flowers, putting it on the coffee table. The place is nicer than he expected from the grimy look of the lobby. The floors have been redone, the walls freshly painted, the ceiling dotted with track lights. The living room has a square dining table in one corner, and a desk and file cabinet set up in another. Three particle board bookcases line one wall. On the dining table there is a pepper mill, a salt cellar, bright, clear-skinned clementines arranged in a bowl. He recognizes versions of things he knows from home, a Kashmiri crewelwork carpet on the floor, Rajasthani silk pillows on the sofa, a cast-iron Nataraj on one of the bookcases. Back in the kitchen, she sets out some olives and some goat cheese coated with ash. She hands him a corkscrew and asks him to open the bottle he's brought to pour himself a glass. She dredges more of the chicken on a plate of flour. The pan is sputtering loudly and has showered the wall behind the stove with oil. He stands there as she refers to a cookbook by Julia Child. He's overwhelmed by the production taking place for his benefit. In spite of the meals they've already shared, he is nervous about eating with her. "When would you like to eat?" she says. "Are you hungry?"
"Whenever. What are you making?"
She looks at him doubtfully.
"Coq au vin?"
"I haven't made it before. I just found out you're supposed to cook it 24 hours in advance. I'm afraid I'm running a bit behind." He shrugs. "It already smells great. I'll help you." He rolls up his sleeves. "What can I do?"
"Let's see," she says, reading.
"Oh, okay. You can take those onions and make X's in the bottom with a knife and drop them into that pan. In with the chicken?"
"No, shoot."
She kneels down and retrieves a pot from one of the lower cupboards. "In here. They need to boil for a minute, and then you take them out." He does as he's told, filling the pan with water and turning on the flame. He finds a knife and scores the onions, as he had once been taught to do with Brussels sprouts in the Ratliff's kitchen. He watches her measure wine and tomato paste into the pan containing the chicken. She searches in a cupboard for a stainless steel spice caddy and throws in a bay leaf.
"Of course, my mother is appalled that I'm not making you Indian food," she says, studying the contents of the pan.
"You told her I was coming over?"
"She happened to call today."
Then she asks him, "What about you? Have you been giving your mother updates?"
"I haven't gone out of my way, but she probably suspects something given that it's a Saturday and I'm not at home with her and Sonia."
Moshumi leans over the pan, watching the contents come to a simmer, prodding the pieces of chicken with a wooden spoon. She glances back at the recipe. "I think I need to add more liquid," she says, pouring water from a tea kettle into the pan, causing her glasses to steam.
"I can't see," she laughs, stepping away so that she stands a bit closer to him.
The CD has ended, and the apartment is silent, apart from the sounds on the stove. She turns to him, still laughing, her eyes still obscured. She holds up her hands, messy from cooking, coated with flour and chicken fat.
"Would you mind taking these off for me?"
With both hands, he pries the glasses from her face, clasping the frames where they meet her temples. He puts them on the counter, and then he leans over and kisses her. He touches his finger to her bare arms, cool in spite of the warmth of the kitchen. He presses her close, a hand at the small of her back, against the knot of her dress, tasting the warm, slightly sour tang of her mouth. They make their way through the living room to the bedroom. He sees a box spring and mattress without a frame. He unties the knot at the back of her dress with difficulty, then swiftly undoes the long zipper, leaving a small black pool at her feet. In the light cast from the living room, he glimpses black mesh underwear and a matching bra. She is curvier than she appears clothed, her breasts fuller, her hips generously flared. They make love on top of the covers, quickly, efficiently, as if they've known each other's bodies for years. But when they are finished, she switches on the lamp by her bed, and they examine each other, quietly discovering moles and marks and ribs.
"Who would have thought," she says, her voice tired, satisfied.
She is smiling, her eyes partly closed. He looks down at her face.
"You're beautiful."
"And you.
Can you even see me without those glasses?"
"Only if you stay close," she says.
"Then I'd better not move."
"Don't." They peel back the covers and lie together, sticky and spent in each other's arms. He begins to kiss her again, and she wraps her legs around him. But the smell of something burning causes them to bolt naked from the bed, rushing comically to the kitchen, laughing. The sauce has evaporated and the chicken is irreparably scorched, so much so that the pan itself has to be thrown away. By then they are starving, and because they lack the energy either to go out or to prepare another meal, they end up ordering in, feeding each other tart, tiny wedges of clementines as they wait for Chinese food to arrive. Within 3 months, they have clothes and toothbrushes at each other's apartments. He sees her for entire weekends without makeup, sees her with gray shadows under her eyes as she types papers at her desk, and when he kisses her head, he tastes the oil that accumulates on her scalp between shampoos. He sees the hair that grows on her legs between waxings, the black roots that emerge between appointments at the salon, and in these moments, these glimpses, he believes he has known no greater intimacy. He learns that she sleeps, always, with her left leg straight and her right leg bent, ankle over knee, in the shape of a four. He learns that she is prone to snoring ever so faintly, sounding like a lawnmower that will not start, and to gnashing her jaws, which he massages for her as she sleeps. At restaurants and bars, they sometimes slip Bengali phrases into their conversation in order to comment with impunity on another diner's unfortunate hair or shoes. They talk endlessly about how they know and do not know each other. In a way, there is little to explain. There had been the same parties to attend when they were growing up, the same episodes of The Love Boat and Fantasy Island the children watched as the parents feasted in another part of the house, the same meals served to them on paper plates, the carpets lined with newspapers when the hosts happened to be particularly fastidious. He can imagine her life even after she and her family moved away to New Jersey easily. He can imagine the large suburban house her family owned, the china cabinet in the dining room, her mother's prized possession, the large public high school in which she had excelled but that she had miserably attended. There had been the same frequent trips to Calcutta, being plucked out of their American lives for months at a time. They calculate the many months that they were in that distant city together, on trips that had overlapped by weeks and once by months, unaware of each other's presence. They talk about how they are both routinely assumed to be Greek, Egyptian, Mexican. Even in this misrendering, they are joined. She speaks with nostalgia of the years her family had spent in England, living at first in London, which she barely remembers, and then in a brick semi-detached house in Croydon, with rose bushes in front. She describes the narrow house, the gas fireplaces, the dank odor of the bathrooms, eating Weetabix and hot milk for breakfast, wearing a uniform to school. She tells him that she had hated moving to America, that she had held on to her British accent for as long as she could. For some reason, her parents feared America much more than England, perhaps because of its vastness, or perhaps because in their minds it had less of a link to India. A few months before their arrival in Massachusetts, a child had disappeared while playing in his yard and was never found. For a long time afterward, there were posters in the supermarket. She remembers always having to call her mother every time she and her friends moved to another house in the neighborhood, a house visible from her own, to play with another girl's toys, to have another family's cookies and punch. She would have to excuse herself upon entering and ask for the telephone. The American mothers were at once charmed and perplexed by her sense of duty. "I'm at Anna's house," she would report to her mother in English. "I'm at Sue's." He does not feel insulted when she tells him that for most of her life, he was exactly the sort of person she had sought to avoid. If anything, it flatters him. From earliest girlhood, she says, she had been determined not to allow her parents to have a hand in her marriage. She had always been admonished not to marry an American, as had he. But he gathers that in her case these warnings had been relentless, and had therefore plagued her far more than they had him. When she was only 5 years old, she was asked by her relatives if she planned to get married in a red sari or a white gown. Though she had refused to indulge them, she knew even then what the correct response was. By the time she was 12, she had made a pact, with two other Bengali girls she knew, never to marry a Bengali man. They had written a statement vowing never to do so, and spit on it at the same time, and buried it somewhere in her parents' backyard. From the onset of adolescence, she had been subjected to a series of unsuccessful schemes. Every so often a small group of unmarried Bengali men materialized in the house, young colleagues of her father's. She never spoke to them. She strutted upstairs with the excuse of homework and did not come downstairs to say goodbye. During summer visits to Calcutta, strange men mysteriously appeared in the sitting room of her grandparents' flat. Once on a train to Durgapur to visit an uncle, a couple had been bold enough to ask her parents if she was engaged. They had a son doing his surgical residency in Michigan. "Aren't you going to arrange a wedding for her?" relatives would ask her parents. Their inquiries had filled her with a cold dread. She hated the way they would talk of the details of her wedding, the menu, and the different colors of saris she would wear for the different ceremonies, as if it were a fixed certainty in her life. She hated when her grandmother would unlock her almari, showing her which jewels would be hers when the day came. The shameful truth was that she was not involved, was in fact desperately lonely. She had rebuffed the Indian men she wasn't interested in, and she had been forbidden as a teenager to date. In college, she had harbored lengthy infatuations with students with whom she never spoke, with professors and TAs. In her mind, she would have relationships with these men, structuring her days around chance meetings in the library, or a conversation during office hours, or the one class she and a fellow student shared. So that even now, she associated a particular year of college with the man or boy she had silently, faithfully, absurdly desired. Occasionally, one of her infatuations would culminate in a lunch or coffee date, an encounter on which she would pin all her hopes, but which would lead to nothing. In reality, there had been no one, so that toward the end of college, as graduation loomed, she was convinced in her bones that there would be no one at all. Sometimes she wondered if it was her horror of being married to someone she didn't love that had caused her subconsciously to shut herself off. She shakes her head as she speaks, irritated with having revisited this aspect of her past. Even now, she regrets herself as a teenager. She regrets her obedience, her long, unstyled hair, her piano lessons and lace-collared shirts. She regrets her mortifying lack of confidence, the extra 10 pounds she carried on her frame during puberty. "No wonder you never talked to me back then," she says. He feels tenderness towards her when she disparages herself this way. And though he had witnessed that stage of her himself, he can no longer picture it. Those vague recollections of her he's carried with him all his life have been wiped clean, replaced by the woman he knows now. At Brown, her rebellion had been academic. At her parents' insistence, she had majored in chemistry, for they were hopeful she would follow in her father's footsteps. Without telling them, she had pursued a double major in French. Immersing herself in a third language, a third culture, had been her refuge. She approached French, unlike things American or Indian, without guilt or misgiving or expectation of any kind. It was easier to turn her back on the two countries that could claim her in favor of one that had no claim whatsoever. Her 4 years of secret study had prepared her, at the end of college, to escape as far as possible. She told her parents she had no intention of being a chemist, and deaf to their protests, she had scraped together all the money she had and moved to Paris, with no specific plans. Suddenly it was easy. After years of being convinced she would never have a lover, she began to fall effortlessly into affairs. With no hesitation, she had allowed men to seduce her in cafes, in parks, while she gazed at paintings in museums. She gave herself openly, completely, not caring about the consequences. She was exactly the same person, looked and behaved the same way, and yet suddenly, in that new city, she was transformed into the kind of girl she had once envied, had believed she would never become. She allowed the men to buy her drinks, dinners, later to take her in taxis to their apartments, in neighborhoods she had not yet discovered on her own. In retrospect, she saw that her sudden lack of inhibition had intoxicated her more than any of the men had. Some of them had been married, far older, fathers to children in secondary school. The men had been French for the most part, but also German, Persian, Italian, Lebanese. There were days she slept with one man after lunch, another after dinner. "They were a bit excessive," she tells Goggle with a roll of her eyes, the type to lavish her with perfume and jewels. She found a job working for an agency, helping American business people learn conversational French, and French business people learn conversational English. She would meet them in cafes or speak with them by phone, asking questions about their families, their backgrounds, their favorite books and foods. She began to socialize with other American expatriates. Her fiancé was part of that crowd. He was an investment banker from New York, living in Paris for a year. His name was Graham. She had fallen in love and very quickly moved in with him. It was for Graham that she'd applied to NYU. They took a place together on York Avenue. They lived there in secret, with two telephone lines so that her parents would never know. When her parents came to the city, he had disappeared to a hotel, removing all traces of himself from the apartment. It had been exciting at first, maintaining such an elaborate lie. But then it had gotten tiresome, impossible. She brought him home to New Jersey, prepared herself for battle. But in fact, to her enormous surprise, her parents were relieved. By then she was old enough so it didn't matter to them that he was an American. Enough of their friends' children had married Americans, had produced pale, dark-haired, half-American grandchildren, and none of it was as terrible as they had feared. And so her parents did their best to accept him. They told their Bengali friends that Graham was well-behaved, Ivy-educated, earned an impressive salary. They learned to overlook the fact that his parents were divorced, that his father had remarried not once but twice, that his second wife was only 10 years older than Moshumi. One night, in a taxi stuck in midtown traffic, she had impulsively asked him to marry her. Looking back on it, She supposed it was all those years of people attempting to claim her, choose her, or feeling an invisible net cast around her that had led her to this proposal. Graham had accepted, gave her his grandmother's diamond. He had agreed to fly with her and her parents to Calcutta to meet her extended family and ask for her grandparents' blessing. He had charmed them all, learned to sit on the floor and eat with his fingers, take the dust from her grandparents' feet. He had visited the homes of dozens of her relatives, eaten the plates full of syrupy mishti, patiently posed for countless photographs on rooftops, surrounded by her cousins. He had agreed to a Hindu wedding, and so she and her mother had gone shopping in Gurdwara and Newmarket, selected a dozen saris, gold jewelry in red cases with purple velvet linings, a dhoti and a topper for Graham that her mother carried by hand on the plane ride back. The wedding was planned for summer in New Jersey, an engagement party thrown, a few gifts already received. Her mother had typed up an explanation of Bengali wedding rituals on the computer and mailed it to all the Americans on the guest list. A photograph of the two of them was taken for the local paper in her parents' town. A few weeks before the wedding, they were out to dinner with friends, getting happily drunk, and she heard Graham talking about their time in Calcutta. To her surprise, he was complaining about it, commenting that he found it taxing, found the culture repressed. All they did was visit her relatives, he said. Though he thought the city was fascinating, the society, in his opinion, was somewhat provincial. People tended to stay at home most of the time. There was nothing to drink. Imagine dealing with 50 in-laws without alcohol. I couldn't even hold her hand on the street without attracting stares, he had said. She had listened to him, partly sympathetic, partly horrified. For it was one thing for her to reject her background, to be critical of her family's heritage, another to hear it from him. She realized that he had fooled everyone, including her. On their walk home from the restaurant, she brought it up, saying that his comments had upset her. Why hadn't he told her these things? Was he only pretending to enjoy himself all that time? They began to argue, a chasm opening up between them, swallowing them, and suddenly, in a rage, she had removed his grandmother's ring from her finger and tossed it into the street, into oncoming traffic. And then Graham had struck her on the face as pedestrians watched. By the end of the week, he had moved out of the apartment they shared. She stopped going to school, filed for incompletes in all her classes. She swallowed half a bottle of pills, was forced to drink charcoal in an emergency room. She was given a referral to a therapist. She called her advisor at NYU, told him she'd had a nervous breakdown, took off the rest of the semester. The wedding was canceled, hundreds of phone calls made. They lost the deposit they'd paid to Shah Jahan caterers, as well as to their honeymoon destination, Palace on Wheels. The gold was taken to a bank vault, the saris and blouses and petticoats put away in a moth-proof box. Her first impulse was to move back to Paris, but she was in school, too invested to drop out, and besides, she had no money for that. She fled the apartment on York Avenue, unable to afford it on her own. She refused to go home to her parents. Some friends in Brooklyn took her in. It was painful, she told him, living with a couple at that particular time, listening to them shower together in the mornings, watching them kiss and shut the door to their bedroom at the end of each night. But in the beginning, she could not face being alone. She started temping. By the time she'd saved enough money to move to her own place in the East Village, she was thankful to be alone. All summer she went to movies by herself, sometimes as many as three a day. She bought TV Guide every week and would read it from cover to cover, planning her nights around her favorite shows. She began to subsist on a diet of raita and triscuits. She grew thinner than she'd ever been in her life, so that in the few pictures taken of her in that period, her face is faintly unrecognizable. She went to end-of-summer sales and bought everything in a size 4. 6 months later, she would be forced to donate it all to a thrift shop. When autumn came, she threw herself into her studies, catching up on all the work she had abandoned that spring, began every now and then to date. And then one day her mother called, asking if she remembered a boy named Goggle. Chapter 9. They marry within a year, at a Doubletree hotel in New Jersey, close to the suburb where her parents live. It's not the type of wedding either of them really wants. They would have preferred the sort of venues their American friends choose, the Brooklyn Botanic Gardens, or the Metropolitan Club, or the Boathouse in Central Park. They would have preferred a sit-down dinner, jazz played during the reception, black-and-white photographs, keeping things small. But their parents insist on inviting close to 300 people and serving Indian food and providing easy parking for all the guests. Goggle and Moshimi agree that it's better to give in to these expectations than to put up a fight. It's what they deserve, they joke, for having listened to their mothers and for getting together in the first place. And the fact that they are united in their resignation makes the consequences somewhat bearable. Within weeks of announcing their engagement, the date is settled, the hotel booked, the menu decided, and though for a while there are nightly phone calls, her mother asking if they prefer sheet cake or layers, sage or rose-colored napkins, Chardonnay or Chablis, there's little for either Goggle or Moshimi to do other than listen and say yes, whichever seems best. It all sounds fine. Consider yourselves lucky, Goggle's co-workers tell him. Planning a wedding is incredibly stressful, the first real trial of a marriage, they say. Still, it feels a little strange to be so uninvolved in his own wedding, and he is reminded of the many other celebrations in his life, all the birthdays and graduation parties his parents had thrown when he was growing up, in his honor, attended by his parents' friends, occasions from which he had always felt at a slight remove. The Saturday of the wedding, they pack suitcases, rent a car, and drive down to New Jersey, separating only when they get to the hotel, where they are claimed one last time by their respective families. Starting tomorrow, he realizes with a shock, he and Moshimi will be regarded as a family of their own. They have not seen the hotel beforehand. Its most memorable feature is a glass elevator that rises and falls ceaselessly at its center, much to the amusement of children and adults alike. The rooms are gathered around successive elliptical balconies that can be seen from the lobby, reminding Goggle of a parking garage. He has a room to himself on a floor with his mother and Sonia and a few of the Ganguly's closest family friends. Moshimi stays chastely on the floor above, next door to her parents, though by now she and Goggle are practically living together at her place. His mother has brought him the things he is to wear, a parchment-colored Punjabi top that had once belonged to his father, a pre-pleated dhoti with a drawstring waist, a pair of nagrai slippers with curling toes. His father had never worn the Punjabi, and Goggle has to hang it in the bathroom, hot water running in the shower to get the creases out. His blessings are always with you, his mother says, reaching up and placing both her hands for a moment on his head. For the first time since his father's death, she is dressed with care, wearing a pretty pale green sari, a pearl necklace at her throat, has agreed to let Sonia put some lipstick on her lips. Is it too much? His mother worries, regarding herself in the mirror. Still, he has not seen her looking this lovely, this happy, this excited in years. Sonia wears a sari too, fuchsia with silver embroidery, a red rose stuck into her hair. She gives him a box wrapped in tissue. What's this? He asks. You didn't think I forgot your 30th birthday, did you? It had been a few days ago, a weeknight he and Moshimi had both been too busy to celebrate properly. Even his mother, preoccupied with last-minute wedding details, had forgotten to call him first thing in the morning, as she normally did. I think I'm officially at the age when I want people to forget my birthday, he says, accepting the gift. Poor Goggles. Inside, he finds a small bottle of bourbon and a red leather flask. I had it engraved, she says, and when he turns the flask over, he sees the letters NG. He remembers poking his head into Sonia's room years ago, telling her about his decision to change his name to Nikhil. She'd been 13 or so, doing her homework on her bed. You can't do that, she'd told him then, shaking her head, and when he'd asked her why not, she'd simply said, because you can't, because you're Goggle. He watches her now, applying her makeup in his room, pulling at the skin next to her eye and painting a thin black line on the lid, and he recalls photographs of his mother at her own wedding. You're next, you know, he says. Don't remind me, she grimaces, then laughs. Their shared giddiness, the excitement of the preparations, saddens him, all of it reminding him that his father is dead. He imagines his father wearing an outfit similar to his own, a shawl draped over one shoulder, as he used to during Pujo. The ensemble he fears looks silly on himself would have looked dignified, elegant, befitting his father in a way he knows it does not him. The nagrais are a size too large and need to be stuffed with tissues. Unlike Moshimi, who is having her hair and makeup professionally styled and applied, Goggle is ready in a matter of minutes. He regrets not having brought his running shoes along. He could have done a few miles on the treadmill before preparing himself for the event. There is an hour-long watered-down Hindu ceremony on a platform covered with sheets. Goggle and Moshimi sit cross-legged, first opposite each other, then side by side. The guests sit facing them in folding metal chairs. The accordion wall between two windowless banquet rooms, with drop ceilings, has been opened up to expand the space. A video camera and handheld white lights hover above their faces. Chennai music plays on a boombox. Nothing has been rehearsed or explained to them beforehand. A cluster of mashis and meshos surround them, telling them continually what to do, when to speak or stand, or throw flowers at a small brass urn. The priest is a friend of Moshumi's parents, an anesthesiologist who happens to be a Brahmin. Offerings are made to pictures of their grandparents and his father, rice poured into a pyre that they are forbidden by the management of the hotel to ignite. He thinks of his parents, strangers until this moment, two people who had not spoken until after they were actually wed. Suddenly, sitting next to Moshumi, he realizes what it means, and he is astonished by his parents' courage, the obedience that must have been involved in doing such a thing. It's the first time he's seen Moshimi in a sari, apart from all those pujos years ago, which she had suffered through silently. She has about 20 pounds of gold on her. At one point, when they are sitting face to face, their hands wrapped up together in a checkered cloth, he counts 11 necklaces. Two enormous paisleys have been painted in red and white on her cheeks. Until now, he has continued to call Moshimi's father Shubir Mesho, and her mother Rina Mashi, as he always has, as if they were still his uncle and aunt, as if Moshumi were still a sort of cousin. But by the end of the night, he will become their son-in-law, and so be expected to address them as his second set of parents, an alternative Baba and Ma. For the reception, he changes into a suit, she into a red Banarasi gown with spaghetti straps, something she designed for herself and had made by a seamstress friend. She wears the gown in spite of her mother's protests.
What was wrong with the salwar kameez, she wanted to know.
And when Moshimi happens to forget her shawl on a chair and bares her slim bronze shoulders, which quietly sparkle from a special powder she's applied to them, her mother manages, in the midst of that great crowd, to shoot her reproachful glances, which Moshimi ignores. Countless people come to congratulate Goggle, saying they had seen him when he was so little, asking him to pose for photographs, to wrap his arms around families and smile. He is numbly drunk through it all, thanks to the open bar her parents have sprung for. Moshimi is horrified in the banquet room to see tables wreathed with tulle, the ivy and baby's breath twisted around the columns. They bump into each other on her way out of the ladies' room and exchange a quick kiss, the smoke on her breath faintly masked by the mint she is chewing. He imagines her smoking in the stall, the lid of the toilet seat down. They've barely said a word to each other all evening. Throughout the ceremony, she'd kept her eyes lowered, and during the reception, each time he'd looked at her, she'd been deep in conversation with people he didn't know. He wants to be alone with her suddenly, wishes they could sneak off to her room or his, ignore the rest of the party, as he would when he was a boy. "Come on," he urges, motioning toward the glass elevator. 15 minutes. No one will notice." But the dinner has begun, and table numbers are being called one by one on the loudspeaker. "I need someone to redo my hair," she says. The heated silver chafing dishes are labeled for the American guests. It's typical North Indian fare, mounds of hot pink tandoori, aloo gobi and thick orange sauce. He overhears someone in the line saying the chickpeas have gone bad. They sit at the head table in the center of the room, with his mother and Sonia, her parents, and a handful of her relatives visiting from Calcutta, and her brother Samrat, who is missing out on his orientation at the University of Chicago in order to attend the wedding. There are awkward champagne toasts and speeches by their families, their parents' friends. Her father stands up smiling nervously, forgets to raise his glass, and says, "Thank you very much for coming," then turns to Goggle and Moshimi, "Okay, be happy." Forks are tapped against glasses by giggling, sari-clad mashis, instructing them when to kiss. Each time he obliges them and kisses his bride tamely on the cheek. A cake is wheeled out. "Nikhil weds Moshimi," piped across its surface. Moshimi smiles as she always smiles for a camera, her mouth closed, her head tilted slightly downward and to the left. He is aware that together he and Moshimi are fulfilling a collective, deep-seated desire. Because they're both Bengali, everyone can let his hair down a bit. At times, looking out at the guests, he can't help but think that 2 years ago he might have been sitting in the sea of round tables that now surround him, watching her marry another man. The thought crashes over him like an unexpected wave, but quickly he reminds himself that he is the one sitting beside her. The red Banarasi wedding sari and the gold had been bought 2 years ago for her wedding to Graham. This time all her parents have had to do is bring down the boxes from a closet shelf